Welcome to Pod Capers, the official podcast of A Place to Hang Your Cape. And this week, rivers of London, we're talking about waterweed! Cue the music! Hello there, capers, and as I said, welcome to Pod Capers, the official podcast of A Place to Hang Your Cape. My name is Scott James Merridew, and this is the show where we talk about various geek and nerd-related topics, and are joined each week by a very special different guest. We've got two guests on today. Give it up, capers, she's been on the show before, Gillian de Blasio.
Hey.
And we are also joined, very special guest, he is the author and creator of the Rivers of London Peter Grant book series. We're very glad to have him on the show. Give it up, capers, for Ben Aronovich.
Hooray! Hello.
Good to you, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I'm glad to hear it, very glad to hear it. And I am very glad that I got a chance to read Waterweed, because you know what? I really liked it.
Yeah, okay. I really loved the comics.
Well, thank you. I mean, I like writing them because they're much easier than books because somebody else does all the hard work.
Yeah, you got a chained up artist somewhere writing all the things.
I know, it's great because like all the things are actually difficult when you're writing a novel, like creation of mood, character descriptions, nuance of emotion and everything. This is all done by somebody else, so you get all the credit and they do all the work. It's brilliant.
If only someone could do that for podcasts, I'd be a millionaire.
Yes, this is the best thing is you want to get like the James Patterson thing where you just stick your name on it, somebody else does all the work. That's the best bit.
I think that's something that Tom Clancy, well, no longer does, but that's what happens with Tom Clancy now. It's just name goes on anything, even things that are completely and utterly removed. Like, what the hell is Tom Clancy's name going on a video game like The Division? What is happening there?
I do not know. I'm staying away from what Tom. I believe he had a stroke or something at some point. Yeah. So I think, you know, he was just trying to make it. Like, in America, if you have a stroke, it's very serious because, you know, you have to pay for your medication. So
yeah, because it's a dystopian nightmare over there.
I'm not saying nothing. I like Americans and I want them to buy my books.
No, it's a dystopian nightmare, but we can still buy your books.
Well, I prefer not to insult my audiences. It's one of those things, you know except for the French, who don't buy my books, so I'm good with the French.
Cheese-eating surrender monkeys!
Yes, French people. Buy my books! They're good.
Buy his books, goddammit! I don't care where you are. Buy it. If it's available, buy it. If it's not available, steal it.
It's available in lots of places, but it's very, very... My sales are very variable, so I like, you know, some countries have my blessing more than others because of that.
But you have had an enormous amount of success in recent years with the River of London series. They have really taken off.
Well, the books took off in a very unexpected way for everybody concerned, including me, my publisher, my agent. We all sat there. We had very clear expectations of who was going to buy the books. It was basically, you know, it was going to be me. I ran the science fiction and the crime section at Waterstones in Covent Garden. And I wrote, and I thought, I know who's going to come in and buy these books. It's going to be science fiction readers because they're going to come in. The kind of person like me who goes straight to the science fiction section. Slowly and reluctantly, when they find that they've actually read everything in the science fiction section, move gently out to kind of like maybe crime or general fiction if they have to, you know, or usually the graphic novel section first. And I they were going to buy my books. And then I was about 2 weeks into it and I ran into a friend who I'd given a copy to. And I said, how are you enjoying the book? And he said, I don't know. My mum stole it and she won't give it back. And that's when I realized that my audience was not the audience I thought I was going to get. So I have a very wide demographic audience. When I go on tour, I'm always amazed at the kind of diversity and wideness of the kind of groups. It causes the marketing department to go mad because they don't have like a demographic to aim for. They always like to have, you know, like cheese eating, Salisbury wearing woman or something. And they like to aim at that. But it just seems to be read by everybody in a kind of thin layer over the country. So it sold much better than anyone was expecting. And I'm very grateful for that. So,
but I think a lot of it is down to, I think what it is because, yes, it's an urban fantasy novel and there's dime a dozen. There's tons of them out there. But you're telling very human stories with, intermixed with folklore.
I have read plenty of books that do exactly that, that don't sell. I think you just never know what the audience... The audience likes what the audience likes, and they will buy it, and analysis past a certain point. I think one thing is for certain, though. I am benefiting from the kind of post-J.K. Rowling thing, whereas a lot of people who read Harry Potter, who wouldn't read urban fantasy normally, but are comfortable with the idea of magic in a modern setting because they grew up reading Harry Potter, and so they just went, oh, I'll have that as well.
It's like when your friendly neighborhood drug dealer moves away and you have to find a new one.
Yes!
It's not my best analogy, I grant you.
That's not an analogy I'm going to pursue particularly hard, but yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's been a very long time since I had a friendly neighborhood drug dealer, so...
I need my magic fix, man. I need it. I need my urban fantasy. I'm jonesing hard.
I think it's much more it gave a winner, because normally your problem when you're writing science fiction or fantasy is that... I mean, I know this. I used to run, like I said, the science fiction and fantasy section. And I would notice in the shop that other readers would avoid that section. It's not that they wouldn't go check the section. They would actually detour to go around it.
Just give it a wide berth.
Looking at it. And I think I benefited from the fact that a lot of people thought, oh, I don't mind magic in a contemporary setting because I read Harry Potter and that was fine. Mm. Go figure.
Possibly, and then you look at Harry Potter now and you think, wow, it's good that we've got Rivers of London, jeez.
I'm also not going to say anything. I got a lot of Potter fans who read my books who are still Potter fans. I'm saying nothing.
I do not blame you. It's your job to look good. It's my job to bash anyone I don't like.
I'm looking for clickbait here, boys.
We will give it to you. We will give you all the clicks.
All the clicks. I don't want more clickbait. No, thanks.
So I think we should probably start talking about Goddamn Waterweed. So this is the latest in a series of graphic novels based on the Rivers of London series. So just for the benefit of the capers at home, what exactly is Rivers of London about? Let's open up that can of worms casually like.
Well, okay. I always described it as what if Gandalf joined the Sweeney, but that's a very obscure... Obscure one.
All right, Bilbo, we're gonna go and knock someone's head in.
Yeah, it's but you know, well, I like the idea. What kind of like working class magic? I like the idea of like working class heroes with magic. Is what I kind of liked. I would say it's a super. I mean, it's most basic. It's a supernatural police procedural. Or a police procedural fantasy in the way that, say, the Dresden Files is a noir fantasy.
Mm.
A film noir fantasy. Mine is a police procedural fantasy. That's the kind of main distinction between it. It's about a police officer who is guarding a crime scene, who, while guarding the crime scene, meets a ghost, and instead of fainting, dying, running away, or losing his faith in reality, tries to take a witness statement from it. And because he tries to take a witness statement from it, he comes to the attention of the one branch of the Metropolitan Police that deals with magic, and is recruited into that and becomes, you know, taken on as an apprentice. I mean, he wants to become an apprentice. Once, as soon as he finds out it's all real, he pursues it, because I wanted an active, not a passive character, but an active character. And I wanted someone who wasn't the chosen one. I wanted someone who chose himself.
Harry Potter basically has to go to school. That's his whole thing. Chosen from birth, basically inducted into the magical British education system. He hasn't got much choice. Peter Grant chooses the life, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, the point about Peter Grant is that he once he knows it's real, he could walk away from it.
Hmm.
And I didn't really make that clear enough in the book. So a lot of people spent a lot of time thinking, oh, he's got magical talents and that's why he's picked. And I think if I was going to go back and change one thing in the book, I would make that clear. I'd make it clear that he pursues this as a career option rather than have like the whole chosen one. Because, you know, people are very wedded to a series of tropes, you know, the hero's journey. People are very used to, they keep expecting things like, oh, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. And I was deliberately kind of working against that, which is why Nightingale is still alive. You know, there's no dead mentor or stuff like that. And I wanted to avoid a lot of the kind of expectations, not because, you know, I like expectations. I always say that expectations are fine. For example, in a sports movie, your lovable group of rogues, right, and misfits are going to come together and win the final match, or at least get very close to it, have a moral victory. And the fun is in the journey. You know it's going to happen, but you know the fun is in the journey. So there's nothing wrong with following a formula for, say, a story, providing it's entertaining when you do it. But I wasn't being iconoclastic because for the sake of being iconoclastic, I just thought it would be fun to do these things that were not in the normal course of sort of urban fantasy, magician's apprentice kind of stories.
I mean, that's the thing about conventions. They're fun when you use them and they're fun when you don't use them. It's kind of a win-win scenario because there's established conventions that people love and accept, but then when you break convention, people are like, ooh, they're breaking convention. Oh, nice. So yeah, you can't really go wrong.
I mean, the thing is that the genre is a descriptive term, not a prescriptive term. So you describe things because they fit into a genre, but it you don't have to do something just because it's in the genre you're writing in. You don't have to, you don't have to hit a check. There's no checklist. Okay. You can, and genre is a very flexible kind of term. So it's always useful to know what the genre is when you're writing something, but you don't have to be a slave to the genre. The genre doesn't have to sort of like pound you into things. So it's basically about a wizard cops. I mean, it was called Magic Cops for a very long time. That was its working title. I mean, no one was going to let me publish it under that. But for a very, very long time, I couldn't think of a title. So it was like Magic Cops. It's going to be called Magic Cops.
Magic Boys, what you going to do? What you going to do when they come for you?
Basically what it's going to be. Except it was going to be real. I wanted realistic policing because it's more fun. The more realistic you make the policing in the mundane universe, the more fun it is when you ram it up against the fantasy universe. So, for example, Peter Grant has to think, if he arrests a werewolf, whether he's got to, if he sticks him in a cell, is he contravening animal welfare laws? And if he's in a kennel, is he then violating his rights under the European Convention of Human Rights, you see? So, and PACE, for God's sake, if you stick him in a kennel, are you violating PACE, Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which is very, very strict about how you put someone in a cell. So I thought the more you do that, the more fun it is when he runs up against these elements that don't fit into the kind of non-mundane world. So that was kind of like my idea of, I mean, that's my idea of a good time.
I completely agree with you, because I think one of the great things about living right now we are recently expanding our cultural collective consciousness in terms of lots of different things about how we act and how we treat people. And so if magic were to become real, we would have to think about these things. This would be genuine. It would be bizarre, but it would be a genuine thing people have to go through.
Well, I mean, it's like transgender people in bathrooms.
Exactly. Yeah.
What is it? And the answer is usually quite simple. The answer is quite simple with bathrooms, right? But it's actually quite complicated with something like the Police and Criminal Evidence Act.
Yeah.
If you're talking about somebody who might be a dog half the time.
I hate when that happens. It really is awful.
One thing I try to avoid is analogy. So I don't, I try not to have. So the werewolves aren't an analogy for anything. They're just werewolves. The magicians aren't an analogy. Magic isn't an analogy for something. It's just magic.
Because there's a million and one things out there that do that, and nice to take a break from that. It's nice to just have a story with these established things. And talking about the whole police procedure aspect of it, as someone who's done research into police procedure and kind of run up into a bit of a brick wall in terms of writing, what was that like for you, just getting to grips with how the Metropolitan Police actually conduct their work?
Well, I mean, in your case, in Edinburgh, you just have to read Rankin, source of information, or even better, Stuart McBride, if you don't mind the North East. And his stuff is very, very accurate. He's great. I'm always nicking stuff from Stuart McBride because he really does his research. He's got friends, I can tell. He's got friends on the force.
He's connected.
He's connected. So I just did the research and I hope for the best. And I do occasionally get people who are on the job. You say, oh, I like your stuff. It's very realistic. Or occasionally, oh, it's not realistic, in which case I say, yes, please, would you like to be my police advisor? I always recruit people if they criticize me and they have technical knowledge. So it's a very dangerous thing to do, is to tweet me and say, oh, you got this wrong. If you're an actual like physicist or something, I will make you my pet physicist.
Oh, you don't like it? Well, then fix it yourself.
Yes, and now I need to tweet you or email you or just ask you random questions in the middle of the night by whatever medium is I've got. You know, like how do planets work? That kind of stuff.
Dear Neil deGrasse Tyson, quarks, what are they?
Yes. Although the thing with Neil deGrasse, you can probably find that already on YouTube.
Quarks, an easy how-to guide.
I mean, amazingly, policing is quite difficult because of the internet's massive American bias. You can find endless stuff on American policing.
Oh, yeah.
But British policing is less more covered. God help me, German policing is quite hard. Oh. So you generally have to find someone who will talk to you. But it's not, people like to talk about their jobs, so it's not hard. You just got to find people.
Especially if they know that you're going to portray it in as accurate a description as you possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I didn't know that people who work in, say, like the ambulance service can tell the difference between an ambulance siren and a police siren.
Because if you spend that much time around sirens, you're going to develop a bit of an ear.
I mean, it's just because it's your job. So you just go, and some of them can sometimes tell who's driving the ambulance as it goes past by the way they change the gears and stuff. And it's like, people just pick up stuff on the job. So, and fascinating stuff. Ambulance people are the best people for horrible deaths, though, because, of course, they're the first people to arrive at horrible deaths. And so they'll tell you, just get them started. They'll tell you the most amazingly gruesome stories.
It's like therapy for them, I imagine.
I have no idea, but I just keep a notepad handy. That's the main thing. Always have a notepad.
Yeah. And what was cut off him? Oh, God.
Yes. Well, the head coming off was my favourite.
Okay. It's weird to think that those things do happen in real life, and yet with so little a connection with it, and then you hear these stories like, oh, wait, this stuff actually happens. It's so bizarre, just because... I mean, it always reminds me, my dad used to work at my old secondary school, both while I was there and after I left. And I heard at one point when I was at university that they had found the body of an old woman. There's a small lay-by near one of the exits of the school. A body of an old woman, and her head was missing. Not just cut off, it was gone. No one knew could find it. And this was the beginning of the morning, kids coming into school. My dad basically had to organise, right, okay, get the police in here, divert traffic, let's make sure none of the kids get traumatised. And as far as I'm aware, they still don't know what happened.
It's probably
that's
on
crazy.
The beach somewhere.
Yeah.
Probably. It's so bizarre because this is in the Cotswolds. It's a nice place. Nothing bad happens in the Cotswolds.
Everyone always says that about that when it happens in low-density rural areas, you get just as much horrible, horrible crime per capita as you get everywhere else. So it just means there's fewer of you, so you don't expect it. It just means people are more likely to be killed off on the side of the road. And also, out of the countryside, body dumping country, man. It's just so easy to dispose of a body out in the countryside.
I can only imagine. I'm trying to remember, like, he's not a murderer, he's a righty. That's why he knows that.
No, but I mean, I was sitting there and I was doing the next thing, which is a novella called The October Man. It's set in Germany, but this is a universal thing. I thought farmers would make the best murderers because they have... They mostly work on their own around with heavy equipment. So if they want to move a body, they have a tractor trailer. They can wrap it in plastic. They usually have digging equipment that they can dig like a trench in, stick the body in, put the thing in nice and deep so it won't come up. They have access to, you know, chemicals, dissolving chemicals, disinfectant chemicals, industrial style cleaners. I thought if a farmer wants you dead, they will never find the body.
I used to work on a farm. I'm scared now. Oh, God, there was murder going around me and I didn't even know. I was just there for work experience.
There would be unsolved cases. There would be missing persons cases because the body would never be found.
Oh, God. Well, now that we said that, there's a lot of farmers with grudges that are going to get some ideas.
Well, you know, I think farmers are too busy. They don't listen to podcasts, farmers. They're too busy checking the grain prices on Twitter.
It's a good point. So something else I want to talk about, because I'm very into my fantasy, and one of the things I like about fantasy is different magic systems, how magic works, the foundations and the building bricks of it. So when you were creating the series, how much of a priority was creating a magic system for you?
Well, I don't think of, I didn't really prioritize things in those. I wrote the first one in a mad rush because I was broke, going bankrupt, and I was working full time, and I had a kid, and I just basically was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and mangling the keyboards as fast as possible, which I very noticed, by the way, when I'm reading the first book. I go, oh my god! The magic system was very important. I mean, the magic system was important because I wanted three things from my magic system. It had to be something that everyone had could do, right? So I didn't want like people with magical ability. But in that which case, you have to explain why everyone is not doing it. So if you do that, you have to say, why isn't everyone doing magic? And three, I wanted it to follow the laws of thermodynamics in the sense that, you know, you can't just shove huge things. The power has to come from somewhere. And I had to know where the power came from. So I sat down and I had to work out where the power was coming from and what the general rules are. So as a result, I know the basic sort of fundamental rules of the universe. My characters don't. So we're probably never going to find out from, you're never going to find out how it works in detail, because unless Abigail, who is a character who might get into this sort of thing, and the series goes on for a really long time and she does get to Oxford and take a degree in physics, you're never going to find out. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Here's the thing. You don't need to know all the information, because like you could just do like an introductory chapter, like here's how magic works, but that would be boring.
I also wanted a bit of mystery. I mean, I'm a big fan of Jack Vance, the Lioness series, and I love the kind of like wildness of his magic, his kind of unexpectedness and weirdness of it. So I wanted both. I wanted my cake and eat it. I wanted magic that would follow kind of like understandable physics rules, but I wanted whimsy as well. And that's where like the rivers came in. The rivers and the fae and everyone give me a chance to have whimsy and strangeness. Whereas the wizards are all kind of like they have rules and magic follows us off, so like patterns and stuff. And it's like playing the violin, I always say.
One of the things I like about it is that the wizards in this aren't necessarily called wizards; they're called practitioners. It's almost like it goes back to the whole science thing. Science is something that anyone could do, in, you know, big generic words, science. But it's not something that everyone does. You have to practice it. You have to study it. You have to engage with it on a fundamental level. But you're still not going to know everything, because science does not have all the answers, at least not until the device is completed. Don't let me anywhere near a Bunsen burner, dear God. I'm not all into the sciences, but if I was, I would be ruling the world with an iron fist, because I would be such a mad scientist.
Someone pointed out to me that actually all these mad scientists in comic books are all actually engineers.
Oh, that's a point. Yeah.
Because science, you know, a mad scientist would be sitting in a room going, I now know the history of the cosmos, and that would be it. That was all they would do.
I'm going to get it peer reviewed.
Now I will devise an experiment to test whether I am right. Whereas all these mad scientists, I will now build a 10-foot tall robot who will destroy Gotham, you know, blah. And so that's actually, which I think is great, because, like, you know, there is something about, I love engineers because, you know, I like living in the 21st century and having bridges and stuff. But my God, they are scary.
Basically, we've come to the conclusion that farmers are murderers and engineers are mad scientists.
Yep.
Pod capers. Let's abuse random industries. Why not?
Yes, I'm afraid so. No, but farmers, you know, it's not that all farmers are murderers. It's just that if they wanted to be, you'd never find out.
You would never find out.
Especially in America, with the low clear-up rate and everything, and the size of the country, and the sort of very mobile population, you'd just disappear. No one would ever hear from you again. You'd be buried in a field somewhere.
Another reason not to go to America.
Yep. In New Jersey, there was a thing where, like, apparently they found a bunch of, like, dead bodies along a major highway that had just been there for, like months, and nobody knew about it. It was, I don't know if they ever figured out what happened, but, yeah, you know,
yeah.
Hiding in plain sight.
In a nice civilized city, it's much harder to get rid of the body. And if the police have a body, then you're much more likely to get caught. You know, the best way to get, you know, because you nearly always have a connect, unless you're a random serial killer, you're killing someone you know for a reason, and if they know that someone's dead, then they can look for the reasons.
Chain of evidence pattern, and inevitably leads back to you. There's always a trail.
There's always connections, you see, because in cities we're all very sociable, and so therefore we have lots of connections with each other. But out in the countryside, like, you know, especially out in the very sparse countryside where people live like 30 miles apart, I remember going over, I think it was Saskatchewan in Canada, and looking down, and there was this weird grid system. It was snowy, so you could see the roads in the snow, and you could see that there's this like square grid system of roads, and like on every other corner there would be a little farmhouse. And you think, my God, that's imagine growing up there. It's like, can't even see your neighbour. It's amazing.
It is. It would be it's very bizarre because, I mean, we are a social people as human beings. And so it's our connection to other people that really determines how we develop. So that would be very, it's weird for me because I've lived in rural areas in my life, but it's always been rural areas that are still with people.
The Cotswolds, what, population density of 230 people per square kilometre.
Yeah, but see,
that counts as the suburbs.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a suburb.
It's the suburbs. I was right next to Bryce Norton, so there's a lot of traffic in and out of there. So yeah, it is very, very interesting, and that's what I like, because with the countryside, we associate them very heavily with folklore and magic and the eldritch things from beyond the veil of time and space. Not so much the city, which is where urban fantasy comes in. And what I like about it is how you've really integrated this idea of folklore, these river goddesses and fae, into the city itself. Because, I mean, there's goddess of the Thames, for goodness sake.
Well, yeah, I mean, because there's always been the idea that there was a Father Thames. So I just took that basic idea and ran with it. People say, did you take the idea of rivers from? Because there are several cultures which have very strong kind of like river spirit identities, just Japan and Nigeria and places like that. I actually took it from British folklore, where the idea that Father Thames, you know, and there's statues of him. I mean, terrible statues, but there are statues of him. And,
very unflattering.
Well, they make him look like something out of a William Blake. You know, he's got like his beard and hair and everything. And I just basically took that idea and ran with it. I mean, I didn't cleave too closely to the real folklore, because my idea is that there are things that have inspired the folklore rather than the folklore being true. There are things that are behind the folklore. It's a very kind of what's his name? Quatermass and the Pit guy. Oh shit, I forgot his name.
Nigel Neal.
So it's very much kind of Nigel Neal idea that there's something behind the legends. That the legends are there, but they're not the act that you can't just say the legends are truth. There is something behind the legends that inspire the legends to be true, rather than and not always what you expect them to be. So that's what I did. And Waterweed. Waterweed was a lot of fun, because Waterweed is just basically a kind of fun police story with magic. It's a police story with magic. That's what made Waterweed kind of fun.
Yeah, with drugs.
Yeah. Well, you know, because drugs is interesting, and also because there's a lot of people growing cannabis under artificial light, and so basically, is, you know, I'm not going to say what the twist is in Waterweed, but you know what it is. So.
We'll try and avoid spoilers, because we won't be able to go out and buy the damn book.
The comics are a lot of fun for me, because I can do things from other people's points of view. So, whereas the books are very always from Peter's point of view, being the main character, Peter Grant, the comics can be from different people's points of view, and so therefore you can open up the stories in a way. And also, comics can do things that novels can't do. Well, they do things much better. Some things much better. They do ironic contrast, and you can do a one panel flashback in a comic. So you can have that juxtaposition of an image from the past and the present day action either side of the front or of the panels either side, but with the kind of continuity of. Continuity of the text as well. So you can do things like that in the things that you cannot do in comics. You cannot do in books. You can do in things. My favorite one is in Nightwitch, which is, I'm not going to say what it is, but there's a joke that I always wanted to do but just wouldn't be able to do in the books, and it was fun to do it in the comics. And you know, it involves splash pages when you turn over a page. to see a splash page. And so you have to work out, you know, which odd or even page it's supposed to be. So you make sure that it's, you get to the point and then you turn over the page and there is your splash page. You go, da-da! And you make a kind of like, tell a joke or you make a point or you scare the shit out of the audience. And that's one of the beauties of comic books, right? One of the beauties about comic book writing is that sort of thing. I love doing that. They annihilate time. You can stretch time out. You can compress time. You can jump around in time in a way that you can't really do unless you're a weird experimental Booker Prize winning author, in which case nobody reads your books anyway. So
no one cares, Salman Rushdie.
No, I don't. I think I care about Salman Rushdie, but you know, I can't name the last Booker Prize winner. I've forgotten his name already, or her, possibly. Then
I can't remember. I just see a book I like. I thought I'll give that a try. Boom, and
I know I have a go. I nearly always have a go at the Booker Prize winner every year. I try because I think, you know, well, someone put a lot of effort into this prize. But I've got to say, I've got very low taste. I always have.
You've got different taste. There's no such thing as low taste.
No, my tastes are low. I know what my tastes are, darling. Mine low. Low is my taste.
Oh, low. And it's interesting because we're working for so long in. I don't even know what to call now, because like with graphic novels and comics, they're definitely a visual medium. I don't know really what to. They're a prose medium, absolutely. But it's one of those things where it takes place. The action takes place entirely in your mind. It's, you imagine Peter Grant and the events that happened to him just in your head based on whatever descriptions are given of the character and the events in general. And it's very subjective and introspective, I think. And I've always found that fascinating compared to graphic novels, because they're a visual medium. It's much more rigidly defined, much more set out. It's a lot less subjective. Was that something you were concerned with, or something that you were looking forward to?
Books are the closest thing to telepathy we're ever going to get, because it goes down from my mind onto the page and then from your mind onto the page onto your mind. That's almost totally unmitigated by anybody else's input, if you see what I mean. Whereas a graphic novel, you have the artist. So it goes onto the page, the graphic artist has his interpretation, and then you interpret it, the pictures and the words yourself. So you get in the relay. But that allows... So, the other thing is you've got you're working with someone who has to produce or has a month to produce 22 pages, right, including likenesses, and it's incredibly hard work. It's very hard to do the inking, the drawing for a graphic novel. So I don't necessarily think the characters in the graphic novel look the way I think they should look, but I have to a certain extent allow my artist to be comfortable with the characterizations they're making. Because they're the ones that have to draw them day in, day out, and keep, you know, Nightingale has to look the same from frame to frame. Peter has to look the same from frame to frame. Beverly has to look the same from frame to frame. And so, therefore, people don't necessarily look the way you think they're going to look. And you have to allow them their creativity, otherwise they'll go stale on you and they won't do a good job. So it's not just their job to interpret what you do. It is they also have to bring their own creativity to it. And the same with the colouring as well. The colourist is very, very important. We had a brilliant colourist, and so the colouring is very, very important on the comics as well, because they make all the difference. You look at the line and then you look at the colouring, you look at the massive difference it makes, especially there's one called Detective Stories, which is where we use loads of different art styles all the way through to tell the story, and the colouring and the right drawing is really important. But I don't have any control over that. So I have to trust in the people who are coming after me in the process. And that's the big difference between prose and comics. And again, between prose and script writing, where you are literally the beginning of an enormous process involving like 90 people. You know, and that's a small crew going forward. And so therefore, all of whom have their own input to make, and all the things will change it. So that's the big difference between novels. Novels is you are going brain to brain, but everything else is mitigated through other people. And so therefore, it's much more a collaborative activity. But you know, on the other side, it makes it much easier to do. It's much easier to write a comic script than it is to write a novel, I find anyway. Some people find it the other way around.
I mean, it depends on what the kind of person you are, as you say. But I think it's more fun sometimes to just work in a team.
Well, you know, I'm an egotist, so no, I like to... Unless I'm running the team.
I love teams when I'm in charge.
Yeah, basically, I like a team under me.
Like to delegate, absolutely.
I like to delegate, yes, it's a good one. I like a team where I delegate. I don't like working in a team where other people tell me what to do. I would have stayed in the job, you know. I hate work. I hate any kind of work, really, so...
I feel you, bro. I feel your pain.
I the reason I enjoy being a writer so much is because I don't actually consider that to be a job. I just consider it to be something, you know, it's like running, it's like jogging or something. It's like something you do.
If you love it, it's not work.
Yeah, and then you get paid for it. So you're like, it's like that, suckers, you're paying for this.
Ha! I would have done it for free.
Yes. Shh. Lots of people do. I'm amazed at fan fiction. They draw out like novel length things and they just put them out there for people to have for free. And it's like,
what are you doing? Don't you know there's money to be made?
Give it away, for God's sake. Charge them something.
And then you see some of the lesser well-made fan fiction. You think, no, this deserves to be free. This deserves to be free. Oh, yes. dear God, no.
I think fan fiction is fun. I went through a very complex evolution with fan fiction. I started with like all writers, like what I call the barking at the postman stage. All writers resent fan fiction to start with. They won't tell you they do, but they do, because you're like, get away from my work. It's just a natural kind of like a dog barking at the postman. You know it's the postman, but you're still barking. So you go, right, okay, calm, you know.
It doesn't matter that they shipped Peter with Nightingale, that's fine.
It's not so much what they're doing with your characters, it's that they're fucking with your characters altogether in any way whatsoever is what causes you to have that reaction. Then you think, no, it's fine, it's interesting, they can do it. You mustn't ever read it, though. Very, very important. Don't ever read the fan fiction. You shouldn't read the fan fiction for several reasons. One, you know, you will spit blood. Two, you will, but the main thing is you have, you sooner or later you're going to write something that someone has done as fan fiction, just by the sheer law of averages. If there's any, you know, any kind of supply of fan fiction, they're working in the same universe as you created, you are going to do something that somebody else has written, and they're going to think you stole it. You have to be able to say, no, I never read the fan fiction. Just so for the kind of moral, so you can say with a clear conscience, no, I did not steal it from you. I never read fan fiction. That's why I didn't steal it. And so you shouldn't read the fan fiction for that kind of moral and legal reason.
That is some very good advice, actually. I hadn't considered that, to be honest.
Even though fan fiction, I think technically, because they're using your IP, whatever they write, you can nick. But you shouldn't do it anyway, just for moral reasons. And the other thing is, I went through that kind of toleration phase, and I went through kind of amusement phase. Oh my God, 576 Peter Grant Nightingale shipping stories. That's hilarious. And then I thought to myself, you know, they're actually doing you a favor because they're providing, because lots of people, they want Peter and Nightingale, they want some kind of shipping thing, or they want, you know, a story about we can overdo the shipping thing, or they want what they call hurt comfort, or they want just a little story about what was happening while this was happening in the book, something was happening elsewhere, or a what if story, or what if he met Sherlock Holmes, or what if there was a crossover with some other universe. And I thought, they are writing these stories so you don't have to.
It's also free promotion.
Well, I think it is free promotion, but I think they're writing it so you don't have to. I don't have to write that crossover for them to keep them happy. They're keeping themselves happy, and I think that's a good thing.
Now that they've crossed over Rivers of London with Sesame Street, I don't have to.
Yeah, I don't have to do any of that. I don't have to write anything to keep anyone happy that I don't want to write, because I know that somebody else will write something. If someone wants a niche, there's probably someone writing fan fiction of it. And that will say, you know, that's good. Fine. I'm good with that. They're doing me a favor.
Absolutely. You can focus on other things. Now, when I say, I do want to talk about what exactly was the process of collaboration. You talked about what he's like for you with Andrew Cartmell, who wrote Waterweed, and Lee Sullivan, who did the art. What exactly is the process there?
Okay, well, we started off with a joint contract, me and Andrew, because Andrew's had experience writing comics and I hadn't. And we co-wrote Bodywork. I mean, that was definitely co-written in the sense that, you know, I wrote a page, he wrote a page, you sent it backwards and forwards. But we have such different... Our working processes are so different that this didn't really work very well. So he said, right, that's not working very well. What we will do is we will sit down and we'll work out what stories we want to do, and then one of us will take the lead, and then the other one will sort of do the follow-up. So you know, for example, Andrew would write for Waterweed, right? Andrew would write an issue, and then I would go through it, go, no, Peter doesn't talk like that, and no, or yes, that's good, or but what about this? Do you see what I mean? I would essentially script edit it.
You're the George Lucas of it all.
I would. Well, I'm the one that knows all the stuff, right? So, I know what's happening in the next book, so that we don't step on the toes of the next book and stuff, or what's going to happen. But that most of that process starts, you know, we basically go and have a big lunch and discuss what we're going to do. And so that's kind of sorted out. What I do is I do script editing sort of process. And then when I take the lead on one, we reverse the roles. And so therefore I write the issue and he does the script editing process. The relationship with Lee is basically you get to know your artist. And so after a while you start putting in more and more shorthand. So you start off with these, you know, what's his name? Watchman guy. Alan Moore.
Alan Moore. I need to say Neil Gaiman. Why did I say Neil Gaiman?
You start with these Alan Moore length descriptions that go on for like two pages of the spread of each panel, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then after a while, you start doing that only for things where actually the details are very important. Especially when you think about it, I'm doing a naturalistic story. So I'm doing a story set in London. So what we do is like we generally provide Lee, if we think it's going to be difficult for him, we provide Lee with like Google Earth locations so he can see which bit of London we want to be in. We go out and do research, picture research, so that he doesn't have to go searching for, so we make sure he's got the right kind of cars and all that sort of thing. So we try to be as scrupulous as possible in our picture research and stuff, so that, and this is all to help him speed up his process so that he can concentrate on composition and framing and everything rather than worrying about what the ambulance looks like or what the badge on the ambulance should be. So we try and do all that kind of stuff for him. And if we have like very, very fixed, very clear idea of what we sort of like think the thing should be. So if we think it will be strip frames, you know, five or six strip frames coming down the top, because Lee likes to go for very dynamic, you know, frames that change shape and everything, and I like to go for very formulistic frames. So we compromise. I say, Lee, you can do whatever you like on that page as long as these things happen, or I will say, no, five strips down the page, this, and it depends on what I want the story to do and what Lee, but I try and give Lee as much leeway because he's a good artist, and you do not, you know, why keep a dog and bark yourself?
Absolutely, artists are, funnily enough, artists. You need strangely enough, yeah, they need, you know, you've got an idea, you've got a plan, but also you've got to let them do their own thing, because otherwise what you'll have may be exactly what you asked for, but it might not be good.
Yeah, exactly, and so therefore they might have something better. So also, Lee's very good, he does roughs, so he sends us a rough layout, including balloons, which is very, very useful for everyone involved. So that you can look at the rough layout and say, no, I wanted that to be a bit more dynamic, or I wanted that to be, and then we can go back and change the roughs so that when we get to the actual, when he actually does the inks, he doesn't have to spend so much time, you know, we don't have to change the inks very much. And then we go through the inks and make sure all the details are correct. And then the colouring, we go through the colouring. And we know there's something, you know, Nightingale's eyes change colour in a couple of things. And things like that, just because the pressure of production means that you sometimes things slip through. And I'm colorblind, so I don't always spot color things. So I'm a bit stuffed. I'm a bit reliant on other people to spot color problems.
But I think the better your story is and the more invested you are in the world, the less you notice small things like that. If I'm not liking a comic or a novel, I will spot typos or like small little inconsistencies.
No. There are people out there who love you to death and spot typos and will write long essays. and directly contact me and say, I think you'll find that in...
Excuse me, sir. I think you'll find that Nightingale had different coloured eyes in page 6 of here.
And that's fine. I pass that information on. And if we can correct it in a later edition, that's what we do. And if we can't, well, no, we can't.
I used a disparaging voice there. That's me. That's who I am. That's what I do on this show. I find small inconsistencies and I tear them apart. I'm such a hypocrite.
Well, you know, somebody's got to do it.
I think I'm providing a valuable service.
I mean, writers don't have to listen to podcasts. They don't have to listen to podcasts. They don't have to read
Don't tell them that, jeez.
Most writers stop reading reviews after all. I mean, of the you know, they stop write reading reviews because it's just gets, because everyone, they're all contradictory. If you like read any number of good, if you read over like 10 Goodreads reviews of a book, you'll find that three people hated it because of one reason, then three people loved it for the same reason. And if you're a writer, what are you supposed to do? So best just not to read the reviews.
Just be happy that people out there reading and enjoying it.
Well, you know, people try, you know, there's the whole kind of death of the author thing. So they don't like you coming back on a review. So you're not supposed to go and complain about reviews. So you have to say to yourself, well, in that case, reviews are not written for the authors. And so therefore authors shouldn't read reviews.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Just focus on making your next book the best you can possibly do. And I think that's something, well, you've done a lot of books, god damn it, you've done a lot of stuff in this world. Which makes me to think, like, this world is ever expanding. Would we possibly see it in another medium at some point in the future?
You know, you're always trying to flog it to television because of the large sums of money involved. But television's a pain. I've worked in television. And
you were in Doctor Who. You worked on Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I worked on Doctor Who before it was fashionable. I always say that.
I mean, that was the Seventh Doctor. That was the classic era. People love that.
They hated it. The media hated it. The press hated it. The BBC really hated it.
I did. I was given to understand that at that point, the BBC were basically looking for excuses to get rid of it.
I don't know. I mean, it just didn't fit. They didn't like science fiction. They still don't. They don't actually like Doctor Who now. They just can't get rid of it.
All right, Russell T. Davies, we'll give you a chance at Doctor Who. This will never pan out. Oh shit, it's popular. Well,
yeah,
crap.
That's basically. I reckon what I believe that. I mean, I've heard that theory, and I have no proof of that, but I think that's true. I think they wanted him to write lots of psychodramas about, you know, growing up in Wales or wherever he grew up, and Manchester. And in the end, he went, no, I want to do Doctor Who, which, well, God bless him. That's what I say, and all but sail in him.
Absolutely. And when you compare it to other science fiction shows the BBC have done, I mean, I'm sure you could put up one or two examples that are okay, but honestly, for my mind, they've mostly been most acceptable and at worst just completely and utterly uninteresting. And well, I don't because we're the country of science fiction. We basically invented it, thank you very much.
Well, no, the BBC doesn't want to do science fiction unless they can claim it's not really science fiction. And the only exception to that is Doctor Who. You can't really say it's anything else. You can't go, Doctor Who, yes, but it's not really science fiction. So whenever you get to like a something like, they make something like, I don't know, what was the last, Outcasts or whatever.
Oh,
that
yes. Oh, right. I remember Outcast. That was all right, but I knew it wasn't going to get a second series.
I mean, it was terrible. It was terrible from the start. It was, I'm not going to start on Outcast. Like, don't get me started.
I may get you started later, but we'll move on for now.
That had been seriously gibboned. I know, well, my phone keeps tweeting at me. I'm on the phone.
I wondered who that was. Just like, what was that in the background?
Sorry, that's my text thing. That's my text from someone. Hold on. What do they want?
Go away, Spielberg. I'm doing Podcapers right now.
Yes, I'm doing, Podcapers, which I've never heard of, but I'm sure you're brilliant.
Trust me, we are. Trust me, he's not going to look at the other episodes. Anyway.
Listen to this one. Let's make sure you don't say horrible things about me at the end. Just so you know. Before I was distracted, what were we talking about?
We were talking about Doctor Who. We'll move on for the moment. And also, actually, before we move on, actually, Andrew Cartmell, just out of interest, also worked on Doctor Who. Was it around about the same time that he worked on Doctor Who as you were?
No, Andrew Cartmell gave me my first ever job.
Oh, wow.
Doctor Who. So there you go.
Come full circle. Absolutely. So one thing I want to talk about is because the novels, they're fairly long, about average length, I think, for a novel. But the mysteries, the stories, and the investigations take place over a long period of time. Graphic novels, as you say, they're like 22 pages. So what was it like for you condensing these ideas for stories you might have into such a shorter format?
Well, one of the reasons why we didn't do graphic novel versions of the novels was because of that. Because I looked at them and I thought, they're not really going to translate very well Over to comics. You know, you're not really going to... I couldn't really see any value added to doing a graphic novel version of, say, the Rivers of London book, because, you know, I couldn't see any way it would enhance it. So I thought it would be more fun to do original stories that are actually just tailored to. So these stories, I don't have to cram them. They're actually written specifically for graphic novels, and so therefore they are the length they need to be for a graphic novel, rather than a book story that has been condensed down. So everything for the graphic novels has been written totally for the graphic novels, you know, originally for the graphic novels, with no fear. No. So there's no stories in there where I went, oh, this would make a good short story, or this would make a good novel, but I'll do it as a graphic novel instead. They're all purpose written for the graphic novels.
That's why they work. I think you're right. Already you have understood far more about... fictional mediums than any Hollywood producer ever, just because you understand that some things just don't translate well into other mediums. If you did do that, as you say, it would be awful. So you just created these new stories and you've expanded the world. It's another win-win scenario. It makes us more invested.
It's rather like what the MCU have done. They've gone, right, you cannot do some of the stories the way they are done. You know, Thanos cannot be in love with death. It would just look silly. So we'll give Thanos a different motivation.
And it works for that story. It worked fine in the comics, because comics are weird. Yeah. We all know this.
But comics are weird. You know, you have like this multi-universe where we have those kind of weird Doctor Strange kind of, you know, universes where rocks float in the sky and all that kind of stuff that you get in. You know, I'm in another dimension and discs of unspecified energy are flying around and everything like that, and you had a universe like that, so you know, and it was all integrated together, and it was all very incestuous, and so therefore the idea of Thanos trying to, you know, appease death is fine, but you need to kind of like simplify and unify ideas in anyway, he just wouldn't have been nearly so sympathetic as an antagonist if all he wanted to do was impress death.
Yeah, that I'm all for reimagining when reimagining works, which is why I don't like what DC did.
You shouldn't imagine it for the sake of it. You should reimagine it because it will make a better story. The story is what you should be focusing on, so you should do the story.
My adage is, the number one rule, if I ever make it as a writer, if anything, the story comes first. Everything else is secondary. There are other priorities. Everyone has priorities, I know. The story comes first, because if the story doesn't work, it's a knock-on effect.
Well, this is the thing of commercial fiction, you see. If you look at a lot of people who can't write for Toffee, right, I mean in terms of their prose style, like Jeffrey Archer or Dan Brown, right? The thing is, they tell wicked stories, and people will read a wicked story even if the prose isn't that good. But people will not read brilliant prose if the story is crap.
I will admit to liking Dan Brown just a little bit, probably because of that.
Wicked story, so you follow the wicked story. There's lots of people lots of people you read because the story's great. I mean, God help me, the first David Eddings quadrology or whatever it was, you just followed the story. The bloody writing is appalling. The prose, at a prose sentence and paragraph level and characterization level, but the story was very compelling. And if you look at literary fiction, you see they have no story, but the prose is very good. That's the difference. That's essentially what literary fiction is. It's prose with no stories.
And this is interesting because on the opposite side of that spectrum, you've got Stephen King, who writes very, very well, but not all of his stories are particularly engaging, just because they're just a bit too weird. Like, okay, so they're transforming cat people who suck up people's souls. That's weird. What are you doing, Stephen?
I know. The stories are still compelling. He still tells a compelling story. The ideas are weird, but the story is... Yeah, you can get away with weird ideas.
Yeah.
As long as the story... As long as you want to keep turning the page to find out what happens next, it doesn't matter that cats are stopping people from sucking breasts out of kids or something, or whatever that bloody story was about. You know,
I'm talking about the movie he did. That was it. Knights?
Yeah, no. The cat one. The one with the cat. Yeah.
Or the guy from Charmed, and the person who was the Borg Queen.
Yes, but I think in that one he was just looking for an excuse to have like cats doing stuff, so he just came up with that idea for cat. That, you know, you can't read, you know, if you look at his books are very, very dense. His books are very dense and they go on for long. And what he does is he does a lot of scaring by repetition. So therefore, he will take a perfectly innocuous phrase, and then he will, like, over the course of a book, he will load it down with such scary imagery that by the end of it, you're like, ah!
Oh shit, that man has two buttons on his denim jacket! Frightening!
Yes, exactly, you see, and that's how he works, and that's how he scares you, how he scares you. His book on writing is very good, and also so is Dance Macabre, if you want to read something about horror. I rate both of those books as interesting books about writing, and they're quite short as well, which puts them ahead of quite a lot of books about writing.
Yeah, I've mentioned many times on the show that I'm not a big horror guy. I really don't like being scared.
No,
like...
I'm not a horror person either.
But I do find it. Of course you do, Jillian. Of course you do.
It's like weird. It's like I like horror, but like I only like it around Halloween time. Otherwise, I don't want to have anything to do with it.
I don't like horror because I don't need to be depressed there. Because the basic tenet of horror is that you're all going to die horribly. Live with it. That's basically the underlying ideology of horror. Whereas I like my fiction to be a bit more optimistic. Like you might make it out the other end alive. You might live. That's what I want to know.
Where there is life, there is hope.
Yes. Whereas in horror, where there is life, there is the prospect of horrible death.
Oh God. So now you mentioned before that you've been on tour before. You're going to be going on tour anytime soon? You're going to be any comic convention? Something I like to ask people that come on the show.
Not that I know of.
Make plans. There's lots of cons out there. I'm sure they'll be glad to have you.
I'm a very slow writer, and I have to spend a lot of time writing to get anything done whatsoever. So I try to avoid doing things. So I really only go out when I'm forced to.
No, fair enough. I'm very much the same. I don't like to leave the safety of my grotto.
Yes, I like to stay in my grotto. I have to do on quite a lot of compulsory tours. I have to do like tours for the books and stuff. Mm. And the publishers, you know, now I've got like the German publishers like me to go to Germany and stuff like that. So, woe is me, I have to go to Germany.
Oh no, you have to enjoy the lovely sights and tourism of Berlin, a cultural mecca.
No, you do not get any tourism on a tour. Just trust me on this.
you're there to work.
You become a connoisseur of trains and hotels is what you become on. When you're on tour, you learn about trains and hotels. And which ones you like and which ones you don't. And that's basically what you do on tour. And you meet people, but it's nice because you meet people. What you mostly do is meet people. And I like meeting people. So I like going on tour to meet people because otherwise I wouldn't meet anyone at all, really, under any circumstances.
I should go on tour at some point. Then I might actually meet someone who's not over the internet. Everyone I know is on the internet.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Although my problem is I'm old enough to not have an automatic kind of connection between people on the internet and real people. So people say, oh, but we tweet. We're always talking on Twitter. And I think, yeah, but that's not a real, you know, you're not a real person until I meet you. Sorry, that's just, I'm old.
You're not human.
I'm old fashioned. You could be Russian, for all I know. Or possibly are Russian and a very nice person. You could be a bot. Don't know. Anyone GRU members watching this, and you want to give me the gen on the inside of the GRU, I'm up for that.
I've got no. What? What's a GRU?
The Russian military intelligence.
Oh, okay.
Ran the bot farms. You remember the whole thing about the bot farms campaigns in the American elections and stuff. You remember that? Any of that?
Yeah, I'm with you now.
I mean, we still can't stop talking about it over here, so.
But, you know, if anyone wants to talk to me about the actual kind of day-to-day working environment of doing that, who's a GRU member, I'm good, because that sounds like an interesting thing to do a story about.
Russian hackers, get on that. Yep. We want to hear from you. Before we finish off, Gillian, anything else you'd like to ask Ben?
Yes, because Gillian hasn't said anything.
Any
words in edgeways for the last hour.
I'm surprised that I'm still awake.
It is gone 2 a.m. where Gillian is. It's close to 3 a.m, so give her a break, capers.
It's officially 3:01 a.m.
Ooh.
Yeah. I mean, I just really love the comics, like, so much. I actually started reading the comics before I read the novels. And it's funny because I went back and I was reading through, like, the character sheets because I would recognize characters from the novel, and I ended up spoiling future novels for myself. So that was great.
But, darn it! Why does a joy thing spoil the other things?
Yeah, so, and consequently, like, I think certain things, like, I spoiled myself, like, future things that were going to happen in the, like, while I was reading, I would, like, vice versa spoil it, so it was a good time.
I'm sorry to hear that, but, you know, once you're past the spoilers, then you can go back and reread them for different reasons. That's what I always do. I listen to books lots of times.
I don't spoil, but
if I am going to be spoiled, I've never actually found being spoiled has broken my enjoyment of something in the final analysis.
Yeah, and I'm the same way. Like, I've spoiled so many things for myself before, like, by accident or, you know, on purpose, but...
for me, it's a case of, like, I'm still going to enjoy this, but I always wonder, what if I was truly experienced this for the first time and I was completely taken off guard or surprised? And would it have been better? Would it have been worse? I just don't know. It's the road less traveled for me.
Certain things I don't think I would have even looked at unless if I had spoiled it for myself, to be honest.
Well, I mean, there is that. If you know what's coming, you can see the sort of build-up to it.
Yeah.
Because a good twist should make sense. You should be able to go back and go, oh my god, that's what that was about. Oh. And, you know, that's what you should aim for if you're going to do a twist. You should aim for that being the kind of thing that happens.
So that's why the snowman was holding the tennis racket.
Yes, that's why the snowman was holding the tennis racket.
We're going to finish up now, but one thing I want... This is a weird show, you're just realising. One thing I want to finish up with, we said we wouldn't go to spoilers, and I won't, but one thing
that's
I say...
That's a sentence I wasn't expecting to say, certainly.
Anything can happen on Podcapers. Near the end of the graphic novel, there's a couple of characters, I won't say who and I won't say how, are in a court-type scenario. And you made there's a very powerful statement on how... the judiciary system, can be very influenced by appearance and perception. And I wanted to say, as someone who has been on the jury in a court, I want to say that was very, very impactful, that final scene. It was a very, probably the most frightening thing in the entire book, actually. And I want to say that was very, very well done.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's just true, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird when you come in with, like, eldritch monsters and magic and all stuff, that the most mundane thing, a court-type scenario, could be truly terrifying, because that's the thing that really scares me, the idea that bad things happen, but consequences don't occur. Proper consequences.
Although it has to be said, there have been a run of... cases like that where people are scrubbed up for the court. I mean, for a certain extent, you do kind of, like, people always scrub up for court. You have to be very stupid not to scrub up for court.
Tell that to the other members of the jury. I was the only one that wore a suit the whole time.
Well, I wouldn't go for it. Fucking, I had to sit in a jury box for 12 hours. You wouldn't find me wearing a suit, that's for certain. In fact, I don't even think I've got a suit.
This is the High Court of Edinburgh. I had to make an effort.
Old Bailey, I'd go in a sweatshirt.
Fair enough.
Not, but if I was in the bloody dock, you'd see me in. I'd have a tie, and I don't think I've worn a tie for 30 years. But I would wear a tie if I was in the High Court, if I was standing in the dock. I was a defendant, I would be in a tie faster than you can say, scrubbing up for the court.
That is something that the defendant in the case that I was jurying for did not do, but I won't go into that because actually that's kind of a sad story, and we've had a good time on this show. I won't spoil it, and I will start. I think we're on that note. I think we're going to end the show. Thank you very much, Ben, for joining us today. It's been lovely having you.
I've enjoyed myself immensely, and I look forward to listening to it or not listening to it, but getting bad reports about it, where you slag me off, and I have to come back to Edinburgh and have words.
Oh shit, he's coming here. Run!
I'm bound to come to Edinburgh again. I like Scotland, so I'm bound to come up to Scotland sooner or later.
Scotland loves having you, and thank you very much, Gillian, for joining us today. I know it's early or late where you are.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I promise I'll talk more next time.
I don't mind doing things at 6 o'clock in the evening here, and then you can be up nice and early next time.
Yeah, you know.
Well, we would be happy to have you on again in the future. And if you enjoy the show, Capers, please tell your friends, shout it from the rooftops! And if you haven't already, go back and listen to some of our other super episodes, like the last episode we did with Jillian. She talked more on that one. And you can listen to the show on iTunes, Podbean, YouTube, Spotify, or at podcapers.com. We have a Patreon. Check out the rewards. patreon.com/ap2hyc. If you want to get in touch with us, suggest show topics, or maybe come on the show yourself. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at ap2hyc, or email us at podcapers@ap2hyc.com. Thank you very much to Dan Harris for our logo, the lovely microphone with the red and blue 3D glasses. Those are mine. And thank you for listening. This has been Podcapers, the official podcast of A Place to Hang Your Cape. Cue the music!